This coming Saturday, it's your chance. Here's Rafi.
Have a cooperative. Yes, vote for democracy. Stand on guard for your country. We live in a land where people are free. We live in a place with democracy. On election day, we can all have a say in who'll lead this country. So vote for democracy. Vote for the right to be free. Yes, vote for democracy. Stand on guard for your country.
The Community Radio Fund of Canada CRFC funding program, The Radio Matrix, was founded in 2012. It aims to improve local programming and volunteer participation. Since its inception, it enabled a total investment of more than $12 million in the campus and community radio sector. Vancouver Co-op Radio CFRO 100.5 FM is pleased to announce that almost $50,000 will go toward the implementation of the Youth Outreach Project. This is the 12th time that the CRFC provides financial support to Co-op Radio under various programs, bringing the total awarded to almost $263,000. The funds received will be put toward the recruitment of youth programmers to provide sustainable volunteer participation to CFRO radio show collectives. The Youth Outreach Coordinator will be responsible for developing and implementing online, on-air, and in-person volunteer recruitment strategies to attract a steady flow of new programmers to the station. For more information about Co-op Radio and the Youth Outreach Project, please visit coopradio.org.
Hello, and welcome to the fifth episode of Radio Artspeak Digest. And that music we were just listening to was composed by Leif Hall for us. Thank you, Leif.
Thank you.
My name is Eric Hood, and I'm here with Emma Metcalf-Hurst in the studio. And before we get started this evening's program, I'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting live. This studio is located on the unceded and occupied traditional territories of the Musqueam, the Squamish, the Tsleil-Waututh First Nations, and we are thankful to live on these lands as uninvited guests. Artspeak Radio Digest is collectively produced by a group of artists and writers, including Brady Cranfield, Emma Metcalf-Hurst, Autumn Schnell, Gabby Dow, with additional support from Bo Pachai and myself, Eric Hood. ARD takes the form of an audio journal with a new issue presented every Tuesday from, well, it's about 9 o'clock right now, right? Yeah, 9 o'clock. We're on for an hour. This project is an approach to think about ArtSpeak's publishing program but also about the community-driven program that Co-op Radio is, and as well as Artspeak and its neighbors here at the Downtown East Side. This week's program will include a conversation with Deborah Edmiades about her media residency at the Western Front and her ensuing performance, Monologues, Patriarchal Traditions, and the New Age. Next, we'll listen to Brady Granfield's Keywords for Vancouver with special guest and member of Vomit Fraud and founding member of Artspeak, Kay Higgins. But first, the second part of an interview with Emma Metcalf-Hirst and artist Carmen Papilia, talking about the recent panel Carmen organized in partnership with Other Sites for Artists projects and the City of Vancouver's creative city strategy called Disrupting Barriers in the Area of Accessibility. The event was hosted at Lost and Found Cafe, which is at 33 West Hastings, September 29th, which was a Saturday, and consisted of a panel of community voices that offered diverse approaches for accessibility to the cultural and social service sectors. Here's Carmen.
And I make socially engaged work about my own access in various contexts. Open access relies on those present, what their needs are, and how they can find support with each other and in their communities. It is a perpetual negotiation of trust between those who practice support as a mutual exchange.
So you're an accessibility manifesto for the arts was published in 2015 in Canadian Art Magazine. And it was, as you've explained, a kind of response to accessibility failures and came from your own experience with institutional disability support services that kind of failed to meet your needs.
Yeah. So in 2015, I wrote these like five principles for what I called open access. So it was like a set of tenets for just like to, recommendations for like how you connect around support within the midst of like a, within institutional space. I was kind of using it as a framework to like kind of problematize like common notions around accessibility. And so I kind of gathered a few friends together who I knew through Hilary Gache and the Purple Thistle Center as well, that was a youth space, collectively run youth space, and proposed this three-month project where we would conduct like an unsolicited collective accessibility audit of the Vancouver Art Gallery. Mm-hmm. So we were all coming from our, you know, different backgrounds and experiences. Not all the group identified as disabled. There were youth participants, there were folks who were exploring the conditions of being trans, persons of color, you know, one of our friends who we'd worked with in the past, Arlene Bowman, is like a senior Diné filmmaker that was part of this project too. And we're just thinking about accessibility from our subjective positions and then like kind of using that position to like view the Vancouver Art Gallery around this like larger topic of accessibility and not really thinking of the physical aspects of the space, but more like the social, cultural, and political conditions that we felt like affect one's agency within. And we spent like time there exploring topics that we felt were interesting to us, kind of talked up, developed this like methodology that for assessing the of access at the Vancouver Art Gallery. I think the Vancouver Art Gallery is a special place in that it doesn't really make an effort to engage. At least in my experience, with the various ways that I've engaged that institution. So those tenets really speak to how I try to approach accessibility, how I think the spaces that are doing like a really good job of accessibility are, I think they're reflected in those spaces as well. I think Gachet is one of them. I think the Purple Thistle Center was one of them as mm-hmm. well.
Open access is radically different than a set of policies that is enforced in order to facilitate a common experience for a group with definitive needs. It acknowledges that everyone holds a body of local knowledge and is an expert in their own right.
You've talked a little bit about some of the projects that have been going on at Gallery Gachet. And I know you've been involved with Gallery Gachet for a long, long time now?
About 5 years, yeah.
Would you like to expand on some of the particular projects that you've done with Gallery Gachet?
Yeah, I was invited to show my work as part of a show. I think it was in, like, it was early, like 2013, maybe. It was still when I was in grad school in Portland. And that was, like, my introduction to the space. My friend Cecily worked there. At the time, and you know, as a small staff, like very like 4 paid staff members that support the collective, and they make all the decisions about what happens in the space. And I mean, it's also like collectively held around like this shared politics of, you know, demystifying issues relating to mental health, which I think is, you know, it's in the background as like this is what we care about, but I think it just really is a space that welcomes anyone who walks through the door. And in their old space on Cordova, they just had this like really simple wooden ramp that was handmade that they kind of had to haul out to the front door every day they were open. And I mean, that was the first kind of thing you saw when you got to the space is this like handmade wooden ramp. And that was like their commitment to making their space accessible in physically. But like, I think as an ongoing exchange with surrounding community, it really, I think, embodies accessibility as an ongoing practice.
Mm-hmm. A daily practice, in fact.
So that's, you know, that's why I kind of wanted to, like, explore accessibility there. And I think some of my early ideas around that led to open access really came out of, like, spending time with young folks at the Purple Thistle Center and talking about accessibility with them. And I was invited in to do a couple workshops there and lead a couple workshops for youth participants. So, and that really led to the open access tenets. And it's really, I think they're my personal position statement. I wrote them kind of for myself to kind of describe my politics around accessibility. And I've really been, I mean, in some ways, it's a poem about accessibility. In other ways, it's like a rallying call. It's meant to problematize, and I think it is challenging. If you dedicate yourself to practicing accessibility around those terms that are suggested through the open access framework, I think you realize that accessibility can't just be easily just achieved if you check boxes, check the boxes, and you know, you get like the automatic door opener and you have, you know, accessible bathrooms and what have you. It's something that's temporary. Like I don't believe in universal accessibility because I don't think you can account for the changing conditions that are constantly changing, like the social and the cultural and the political conditions. And when we're talking about, you know, access to the arts, I mean, especially in Vancouver, there's, you know, we're in the downtown east side, just on the border of Gastown and downtown east side neighborhood here. And there's, you know, we're in ArtSpeak right now, which is a well-established artist-run center. And, you know, Gachet is, now it's on 9 West Hastings, but there was a chance that it would have to close. And I mean, I think that trauma of that funding cut is still being felt. in the community. And, you know, they're in a space now that they have, like, rent for secure for 10 years through BC Housing, I believe. But still, like, it was a compromise. Like, it was also a lot of stuff got left behind, and I think the inconsistency of, like, operating with no resources and just trying to keep programming consistent for folks because they rely on it. That time is really still working itself out. And, you know, I just think about the move itself too, and, like, the archives and how, like, they didn't have the time or resources or capacity to even document or to maintain their archive. They had to get rid of a bunch of stuff, and I just think about, like, how is the history of that organization being documented, and how is it being understood? And like, a lot of artists who work through that space also are marginalized within the wider arts landscape in Vancouver and don't have access to the artist-run center system.
Right.
So yeah, it's realizing that there's, like, a huge gap between, you know, folks who have access to cultural platforms and folks who don't. And, like, are you having to address your own survival before you are even thinking about how to maintain your art practice? I mean, that's a whole other set of conditions that I think needs to be addressed when we're thinking about access to the arts. And this is what this conversation on Saturday was all about, like, the city, you know, making a commitment to accessibility and inclusion in the cultural sector, where, like, there's, you know, we're talking about artists who experience systemic barriers, and the fact that they, you know, in some cases don't even qualify as artists, like the creative practitioners that exist here and in the downtown Eastside neighborhood, they're expressing, they're finding visibility through their practices, they're representing themselves, sharing their personal narratives of, you know, traumas, struggle, also just, like, they're expressing an experience of living in this place, and they're not part of, you know, they don't have access to grant funding as most other artists do. It's an institution in of itself, but, like, within the context of the downtown Eastside neighborhood, it's, like, a reliable space that people feel welcome at, and they feel like they can go there. So, like, you know, for example, like, when the Balmoral Hotel, yeah, shut down, and I guess there was, like, no notice to residents, and folks came to the gallery to get advocacy services and just to check in to see, like, where they could find support at that time. So I mean, there's a lot of examples like this too. The space is just, you know, people know it as a place to gather for arts and culture.
Open access is the root system of embodied learning. It cultivates trust among those involved and enables each member to self-identify and occupy a point of orientation that is based in complex embodiment.
And how has some of the work that you were doing at Gallery Gachet expanded into larger proximate communities?
Yeah, well, after that auditing project, I organized a sort of, like, a convergence as well, like a 3-day conference about, like, related topics around accessibility from all angles. And then I went on the road and kind of condensed our process, like, with meeting with the artists for the auditing project, into a program that I took to different museums and city departments and universities, and this was, like, in the States, Canada, the UK, and in Europe as well. And I would really work with, like, all, pretty much, like, a cross section of staff if it was, like, a mid-sized institution, really offering workshops on open access, and really introducing open access as, like, a way to problematize current accessibility best practices, because I really feel like they need to be pushed, because they're very much like proposals that are, they're static. They're like, it's a static set of considerations that is usually impairment specific. I think in the ways that like the art institution is oriented, and I mean, it operates as a hierarchy that also is marginalizing just in the way that it is structured. Mm-hmm. So talking about accessibility in these contexts, in institution that, especially with the museum, that is like a colonial enterprise that's built on like a history of, mm-hmm. you know, cultural violence. How do you talk about accessibility and include the effects of colonization? Can we talk about this in a meaningful way, open up a space for accessibility to mean, you know, speaking of like traditions of violence in various contexts, and by the point of view of folks who really are entering from the outside. So I really try to, as even just myself, try to navigate these spaces so they feel... So I feel like I can practice in those spaces, because I consider them to be oppressive as well. Mm-hmm.
And you're coming at it from your own personal lived embodied experience too.
Yeah. So like advocating for accessibility in these ways, and even just the performance of being in the space and working with a group of people and having them each consider their access and the resources that they have access to from their position within the institution. I usually ask people, like, what's your relationship to accessibility? And really having folks think about what's their relationship to a public? Like, what's their response? Do they feel like they have a responsibility to a public? And so sometimes it was, like, these workshops really, like, have folks, even the directors, like, I mean, I'm sitting down often with... you know, everyone from the director to folks who are writing press releases, and, you know, education staff, engagement, curatorial, and really, like, we usually start with, like, an hour-long eyes-shut walking tour, mm-hmm. Just as a way to, like unsettle everybody before we really get into talking about accessibility. But again, bringing folks into a space that I feel comfortable in, having them shut their eyes and link arms and line up behind me, and then I take them on like an hour-long walk, usually in around the galleries or areas that we're holding the workshop in. And then we get like really into open access as like sort of a means of like setting a new precedent with an institution for accessibility, mm-hmm. And perhaps like establishing a sort of relational accessibility program that can like exist alongside their like existing accessibility program, which is usually, I would, by my standards of what accessibility is probably underwhelming and just too little, and probably oriented in such a way to keep people marginalized. So I usually, we don't really talk about, we're mostly talking about accessibility as a topic and reframing that, you know, in terms of, you know, language, but also thinking about accessibility as an ongoing exchange. And I think there's a trend, I think, within the arts landscape where folks are thinking a lot about public engagement and community engagement, and there's like a whole host of funding available for mm-hmm. institutions that want to explore these topics. And like with public engagement, like accessibility is something that like I would hope we're continuing to check in about, mm-hmm. like how we're practicing. You know, who are these like programs serving? I think with public engagement, there's always a question. It comes back to like, how is that benefiting the institution?
Yeah.
So yeah, I like to have folks start to think critically about these practices and really to think about like the resources contained within the institution. And a lot of institutions like to like pose themselves as public, but I would say they are, you know, they fail at being public due to like financial accessibility most of the time. But yeah, I think publicness is like an ongoing effort as well. Like it's so connected to accessibility.
Yeah.
Open access disrupts the disabling conditions that limit one's agency and potential to thrive. It reimagines normalcy as a continuum of embodiments, identities, realities, and learning styles, and operates under the tenet that interdependence is central to a radical restructuring of power.
What is the next step or the next event within the disrupting barriers?
I'm working on a few things right now that kind of are in line with this. I hope to follow up with the city about, you know, around this idea of a cultural endowment for the Downtown East Side neighborhood and kind of like finding more support for folks that are having trouble accessing arts, but also just like, you know, maintaining their organizations and just existing. But like for me, I'm working towards a show for next summer at the Banff Center. And I'm working with animator Heather Smith, making like a PSA about open access, sort of. And that's going to be part of the show. I'm also developing like this touring project that is pretty much like a gathering space that is accessible for myself and the folks that I'm hosting when I'm on the road, like at an institution. And I think it's like an installation, but also something that will evolve over time. And it's an effort for me to like make accessible space for myself within institutions that I'm working in. And that's very much informed by like the conversations that we've been having and that I've been holding with other folks as well. So I'm going to show an in progress kind of prototype of this installation space at the Banff Center this summer.
Great, thanks.
Open access is a temporary, collectively held space where participants can find comfort in disclosing their needs and preferences with one another. It is a responsive support network that adapts as needs and available resources change.
You're listening to ArtSpeak Radio Digest. I'm in the studio here tonight with Emma Metcalf-Hurst. The music and the introduction of the previous piece there was Mobility Device, a public performance that Carmen did with the Great Centurion Marching Band from Century High School in Santa Ana, California. And next, we're going to listen to Deborah Edmiades, who's a Vancouver-based artist whose work you may have seen around Vancouver, various places like, most recently, the Western Front, in a group show at ArtSpeak and Access. She had some work in Haunt, which was at a basement space in East Vancouver on Glen Street, and also at the Evergreen Cultural Center. And here's Deborah and myself. I'm here in the gallery with Deborah Edmiades, who has just finished her media art residency at the Western Front, which was a two-month stint, which culminated in a performance on September the 12th of this year, 2018. And I wanted to welcome you to the gallery, Deborah.
Oh, thanks.
My first question, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind describing formally what that performance looked like, or what people saw when they came in.
Well, there were quite a few elements to the whole work. One of the things I did when I was thinking about doing a performance in the Western Front, I walked in to the Lux and I saw all these windows there, and I was like, shit, I have to do something with these windows, because it was something I've just been very starting to work with, using lighting gels. And I thought, and my studio is a bunker, a concrete bunker, so I have no windows or light or anything at all. So suddenly there was this idea, like, I want to do a window work. A series of images made out of sort of collage lighting gels that went over the five windows of the Western Front. And also, they contain images, so they depict, the images were based on props. And the props were is a group of props that depicts a scientific experiment that's usually associated with, you know, when people talk about free will, this experiment is kind of evoked. So I had sort of been working with the experiment to create these props, but then the images in the windows were based on the props. So it had these images in, but then it also was, because they were lighting gels, it sort of filtered the light in the space. So they were mostly pink, like the sort of the ground of the windows were pink, but then they had these images sort of inset into them. And so that was a major work, actually, doing that, figuring out how to do that. And working with materials. It was a new thing, so I was really excited about that. So there was that, and then people came, and so the idea was people would come and experience the windows, and then the sun would set, and then at dusk, the shutters, because, you know, they have those shutters at the Western Front, one by one are closed, dunk, 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 and then the performance begins. So the performance itself was, it was a lecture. That's what I was thinking of, that format. So it's a lecture, and there's a character, a lectress, who is presenting research, basically. There was a video, and the video were kind of like the visuals to the performance. And I had made them, and the video consisted of video of the props performing this experiment, sort of snippets. So in a way, I was sort of jamming together the performance and the lecture with these, with the footage of these props performing this. There wasn't any real, they weren't like there, I wasn't sort of using them while I talked to illustrate certain things. They were just kind of the backdrop, and they punctuated the different sections of the talk. And so the props never appeared in the performance, but they were also quite a major work, you know, in a way. And I feel like I'm still working with the props. So they were polystyrene props that depict this experiment. And so in this case, it's a subject who's performing an action in time. And so there's an object, a metronome that measures the time. The subject is a 19th century bust of a lady. And then the action is the flexing of a finger. So these are hand mechanized props made out of polystyrene. They're sort of also bisected, so they leak pink light. Also, the bust, her eyes open and close. She has color wheel eyes that are sort of like made with lighting gels, so they're lit from within. What else does she do? That's all she does so far. But I'm planning to get, like, cut her open again and do other stuff. But yeah, so that was... Does that give a paint a good picture, do you think, of what happened? Well, you weren't there, but I also want to say that, as I was saying to you a little bit earlier, Eric, I think what I tend to do, my method of working, is to sort of bite off more than I can chew. And so in one way, this is great, because I end up working with a lot of things at once, and they all sort of play across, so it's almost across different mediums even, which makes it pretty difficult, because they're different, you know, I have to shift into a different mode to work into with each medium, and each one informs the next, but sometimes I feel like there's too much. And so in this, like in the case of this performance, I feel like it fell short for me. I mean, I was really excited about everything I was working with, but in terms of the actual text, I feel like I was still going into it, like grappling with material and not super clear on everything, as well as the character who was the lectress. She was also kind of not fully developed, and she was an important part of it because it's almost like she is a tool, or that's, it's kind of she, that's how I process the research material, through this character who has a certain subjective relationship to the material. It's not objective, but I feel like those were the things actually that really, you know, at the end I was like, oh, I'm kind of not quite on top of this, you know, and so it fell short.
And the peaches and the mangoes that you could sell for me. What do you think my brain is made for? Is it just a container for the mind? This great gray matter. Since they replied, what is your woman? Is she just a container for the child? That soft pink matter. Cotton candy.
In your video work, where you are, I think constantly, a lot of your video work, you do look into the camera and you are looking directly to the audience. Number of your sculptures are looking at themselves basically and getting feedback or looping back into themselves.
I think why I'm working with that gazing comes from that experience I had on a workshop where we were doing this eye gazing, and it was this very, you know, what you could probably say a very vivid religious experience of recognizing another person as this myself. I mean, I talked about this in the performance, but. So I think, but even although before that I was working with eye contact, it's true. So even before this experience that I just talked about, the religious experience, I was thinking about eye contact. But I did come across something that I thought was really interesting, which also I tied into the way I was making work. Still, in a way, it's still one of the ways in which I know what direction to go in. In terms of subject matter and what I want to work in, and I was reading, a lot of it seemed to be about kind of neutralizing some feeling of inadequacy or shame or something like that. That to me, I always feel like shame is a very productive area to sort of work in. And I was really excited when I came across Eve Sedgwick, Eve Kozofsky Sedgwick, who's a, you know, one of the founders of queer theory, I guess, and an essay she wrote, which is actually about Henry James. And it's about shame. She's talking about shame, but she starts off the essay talking about, and I haven't thought about this for a while, but, you know, we always think of shame in terms of, like, prohibition, like it's some sort of transgression of prohibition, but there was some recent psychological research which talks about, you know, they see the shame response in infants, like very, very early on, like already infants having, you know, showing this, the affect of shame, and it's tied to actually more about recognition, but like that when in the sort of mother infant early days, when the mother and infant are kind of bonding and spending time together, and there's a lot of looking at each other, looking into each other's face, and it's for the infant, this is kind of like this identificatory sort of process of like, who am I, what is this, like, you know, and so what happens is if there's a break, or when the gaze is suddenly doesn't see the infant or doesn't reflect back this like accepting, loving thing, it's kind of like the infant experiences shame because they don't sort of see themselves. So here's this idea of shame as being almost like this misrecognition, like you haven't been recognized, you haven't been seen, and so it's this sense of social isolation actually that ensues. So that was like, that made a lot of sense for shame, and even about eye contact, and even with this later religious experience I had of this sort of idea of recognition and this inclusion, you know, the self as being included. And then it also made sense for me in terms of how I've always like been interested in sort of sniffing out these places of inadequacy or shame and then working with that in terms of identity. Yeah, I mean, I really got into performance in the 90s when everyone was doing sort of identity politics and stuff like that.
Now I cry for daylight. Daylight and the sun. Now I cry for daylight. Daylight. Daylight in my heart, daylight in the trees, daylight kisses everything, she can.
That was The Shags, Philosophy of the World, 1969, on Third World Records. We're going to mix it up a little bit. We have a bit of a giveaway right now. One very special Pam Tillis t-shirt. Maybe if you're following us on Instagram, ArtSpeak, ArtSpeak, you see that I'm wearing this pretty fantastic piece of cloth that I got from Window Community Shop on Hastings, which is a great little thrift store. But maybe let's say that the second caller to 604-684-7561, 604-684-7561 gets the Pam Tillis t-shirt. And tonight, Brady's latest keywords for Vancouver with special guest, executive director of Unit Pit Society for Art and Critical Awareness, and the co-owner and operator of Publication Studios in Vancouver, Kay Higgins.
Hello. Welcome to Keywords for Vancouver with Brady Cranfield. It's a series of conversations about a set of interrelated issues that impact the social, political, and economic character of our city. In particular, it's also about how art production, presentation, and reception and the composition and activities of arts local communities fit into an effect that character, Tonight's conversation is with Kay Higgins, the executive director of the UNIT Pitt Society for Art and Critical Awareness and the cooperator of Publication Studio Vancouver. Our topic is, working the vicissitudes of artist-run culture. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Kay Higgins. I'm an artist, publisher, curator. I'm the executive director of the UNIT Pitt Society for Art and Critical Awareness and co-owner of Publication Studio Vancouver.
Hi, Kay.
Hi.
You've been involved in artist-run culture for a long time. Can you give like a summary of the organizations that you've been involved with?
Okay, well, when I was a weird teenager, I started hanging out at artist centers in Calgary, where I grew up, and then did sort of artist-led publishing. You know, bands are artist-run. Pretty much all bands are artist-run. Bands for a little while. Kate Rimmer and Jeff Dirksen and I are credited with starting ArtSpeak in 1986, and we set it up initially in a room provided by Kootenai School of Writing. Ran that for a while. Founded the Pacific Association of Artist-Run Centers because at that time there was no provincial advocacy organization that was really active that represented the kind of culture that I was interested in. After that, Independent Film and Video Alliance for a little while, which is now Independent Media Arts Alliance, Vancouver Cultural Alliance, which is now Alliance for Arts and Culture for 2 years, boards of a whole bunch of things, worked at Vivo, which was Video In then for a year and a half, then UNIT Pitt and Publication Studio, both since 2010, which has been a bit of a slog.
It seems like an inherent part of the artist-run center experience is almost constant hustle and like an overloaded work schedule. How do you manage?
Yeah, I don't know if that's universal or not. I think it has to do a lot with our local circumstances too. But at some point, if you're involved in any kind of art, at some point you're going to be doing stretches of, like, heroic work, which is not really a good thing. If it happens all the time, if you're on a crisis footing, it's really deadening. It means that it's impossible to plan ahead because you're constantly reacting. So running this organization, which has historically had a fairly small budget, and it's kind of hard to dislodge yourself from a category like that. It's not impossible.
You mean institutionally in terms of funding?
Institutionally in terms of funding, in terms of the way that you might be perceived by donors and so on. Well, you know what capitalism is like, right? So there, it's predicated to have winners and then a bunch of losers and a bunch of people who do like middling well and think they're winning. People tend to back the winners because they see how it works, and they do that in politics. And if you're a cheap little place, then it doesn't look like you're winning, even though we turn out tons and tons of programming, have turned out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, on balance, it would be better, smarter, professionally, to work for a major public gallery and do, what, 3-4 shows a year,
right,
instead of 6 or 7 or more and a bunch of public events to go with it.
Right, yeah.
But this is the position we're in, and we feel, I think there's a lot of pressure on the people who do this to go, there's so much that needs to be done. And that's endemic to nonprofits in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm in the position of having this constrained budget and going like, okay, what are the soft categories? If my hard costs like rent, hydro, printers' bills, so on, go up, really I can't not pay those people. And I look at the soft categories, and the biggest soft categories are programming. Like, how much do we pay artists? I don't want to cut that. Mm-hmm. That's crap. The other soft category is salaries.
Right.
That's bad because it means that only people with other forms of support or the ability to live like really seriously frugally, but usually other forms of support, are going to be the ones doing the work and therefore making the decisions.
Right.
Basically, then if you just apply a tiny, tiny teaspoon of class analysis, You go, well, then this means no working class art.
Right.
This means basically it's hard to put forward art that embodies some kind of class analysis, represents something other than bourgeois culture.
Right. I like this use of the expression embodies, because it's not just in terms of its subject matter. So it's not like art that takes as its issue a kind of a general class analysis.
Oh, yeah,
or
didactic,
like a kind
art,
of a didactic,
right?
Art. Yeah, yeah. But it can also be didactic art in the context of the refined, obscure way that a lot of galleries present sort of politicized art.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like, you know, we're just asking questions and not expecting any kind of answers.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you write your artist statement, curatorial statement the right way, everything's political.
Right.
I mean, everything is political, but not everything is political in that way. Not everything is, and I mean, it's art. It's culture. It doesn't necessarily, it does a lot of things, but it doesn't necessarily primarily act as an agent of change. And if you want to do that, then you should look at different forms of organizing as well as making art.
Right.
Which a lot of our friends do.
Yeah.
Right? The number of artists who are really active in, say, the Vancouver Tenants Union is really quite notable.
Mm-hmm.
2014 election, almost by accident, Cope ran pretty hard left slate.
Mm-hmm.
That was composed of a lot of artists and cultural workers.
Right, including your past self.
Yeah, I was there. No, it's myself.
Yeah.
I just got a different name then.
Yeah.
But it's me. It's me.
I absolutely agree that if we want to, you know, affect political and social change, that really needs to be a focus. And maybe making art about affecting social and political change, well, still illuminating and an aspect of that wider movement towards these things, then maybe the most direct way is to be direct about it and to apply yourself as an artist, as a, you know, as a person, as a citizen, yeah. and act in those ways. But I think, though, that there is also a possibility within the institution to facilitate a little bit of that. And I see in the programming that you've done, especially with Unit Pit, that there is a kind of consciousness of engaging publicly in a way that doesn't downplay its political critique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the problem, though, with the art system in general is that it talks a good game.
Mm.
So we can do political critique. Nobody cares. We're artists, right? They just go, oh, well, that's funny. They've got their bizarre ideas.
Mm.
We can do that without significantly reforming the art system in which we work.
Right.
And so the art system's really bad in terms of its class analysis and its class composition.
Mm.
And the art system's really bad in terms of the way it takes on gender. It kind of fetishizes certain things. In terms of the way it takes on identity, it fetishizes identity in kind of the worst way that identity politics can, without making significant change.
Right.
So we still have this incredible imbalance in our major institutions,
right,
where major solo shows for women, nah, not so much. It's like a fraction, right? Major solo shows by artists of color and indigenous artists, it's gotten better, but it's gotten better from near zero.
Right.
During my lifetime, it's like, okay, well, you know, nice progress.
Right. Pretty easy to improve.
But at the same time, it's not changed this fundamental structure where there are hundreds and thousands of cultural workers who are laboring away, who are collectively producing something that's, like, pretty amazing. But the apex of that work pyramid is still male genius.
Right.
Is still this constitution of the solitary, male, often white genius.
Mm.
And it's weird and fake and crappy, and we don't do nearly enough to dismantle it.
Why don't we shift to sort of end, talk about the progressive potential that resides, not always actualized, not always realized, not always enacted, but this progressive institutional and transformative potential that exists at the level of the artist-run center.
Yeah, yeah. The great thing about them is simply that people are coming together collectively to produce culture. Culture is not just art, it's the ideas. And we can get past the lip service by doing a real analysis of what the strengths of these organizations and gatherings are strategically. How can they be used to further all sorts of aims? I mean, by themselves, they're not going to dismantle capitalism. That's a given.
Haven't succeeded so far.
Magic bullets do not work against capitalism. It's not like we're going to come up with some great piece of cultural analysis.
No.
And everybody's going to go, wow, there could be a different world. That's not the thing that's going to happen.
Yeah.
But strategically, we can look at the movements that exist and go, well, what role does culture play in that? Really, we got a lot of work to do and a lot of work that we could do in the larger culture that we still have to do a lot of thinking and planning for it, because it has to be done strategically. We lack resources and we lack time now to actually accomplish meaningful change.
Jeez, supposed to end on a high note.
Yeah, I know. I don't do that. You know I don't do that.
Okay.
But okay, so the high note is that I said all this stuff to a young curator I was working with over a period of several weeks, and she was like, oh, could you be quiet? You're always so depressing. And then I think there was one day she came in and she said, you say all these depressing things, but you show up here every day and you're doing this work. And I'm like, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Show up and do the work.
This has been Keywords for Vancouver with Brady Cranfield. See you next week.
You are listening to ArtSpeak Radio Digest on CFRO 100.5 on your FM radio dial, Vancouver.
And now, for what's the news? ArtSpeak's bulletin of upcoming events here in Vancouver. Tomorrow night, which is Wednesday, 7 p.m., Patricia Reed, Horizonless Futures, which is a public talk at the David Mowa Faguian World Art Center, which is on the second floor. And on Thursday at 2 p.m., in room 2205 on the second floor, there's an informal graduate seminar. You need to RSVP for that one. Also on Thursday at 12:15 p.m., Spark Fireside Artist Talk number 20, featuring Vi Levitt at the Native Education College, which is at 285 East 5th Avenue, and that's put on by the Grunt Gallery. Also on Thursday at 7 p.m., Donna Haraway Storytelling for Earthly Survival, which is a film that was made in 2017 by Fabrizio Terranova. And that's at Cineworks, Independent Filmmakers Society, which is free. Also on Thursday, this one's a little bit closer to us, 7 p.m., Prairie Aunties on the Coast. Readings by Billy Ray Belcourt, Jessica Johns, Emily Riddell. I should say Riddle. I don't know why I said Riddell. Emily Riddell, San Noak, Autumn Schnell. And that's at ArtSpeak. Thursday, 8 p.m., Anti-Fascist Karaoke Lounge Party and Film Screening, Andrea Creamer at Plotted Access Gallery. Friday, Barb Choit, 6 p.m., 100 Lot Contemporary Handmade Art Drawings, New Wall Art, Home Decor Wall on Paper. That's at Macaulay & Co. Also on Friday, 7 p.m., Peanuts Gallery, Ruth Adler, KKA, Andrea Nunes. That's in the alley behind Broad Arts Foundation. Friday, Vancouver Art Book Fair. There's a website, vancouverartbookfair.com. But Thursday, if you buy a membership for $20, you can sneak in for free. Well, not for free, it's $20. That's 6 to 8 on Thursday. Also on Friday at 8 East, Elisa Thorne's Hugh and the trio of Miller, Sillins, and Lowen. Sunday at 1 p.m., Sunday at 7 p.m., I should say, Meet and Marginalia, Nicole Killen, Orchestra A, which is a lecture followed by a dance party, which is DJed by the speaker, and that's at Duplex. Lastly, do not forget to vote. It only works if you vote. Please vote October 20th. And I think that's pretty much it for Volume 5 of ArtSpeak Radio Digests from your hosts, Eric Hood and Emma Metcalf-Hurst. We'd just like to shout out a couple thank yous to Carmen, Deborah, Kay, Kimmett, Robert, and our partners here at Co-op Radio.